Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Thank you for inviting me to speak about the precepts this afternoon. We certainly do make a fuss over them, don't we? I mean, last night you had the Reverend Abbott talking to you about the importance of the precepts, and this afternoon, what have you got? Me hammering away on the same topic. Why do we do this? Why do we make such a fuss over them? Well, I think there are several reasons. I'd like to share those with you and go into a little more depth on providing some of the details behind what Reverend Master Echo was telling you yesterday evening. Three things occur to me as to why we find them so important and talk about them so much at a time like this. One is that the taking of precepts is the ancient way of becoming a Buddhist within our tradition. The second is that the keeping of them is the single most effective thing you can do right now in Buddhist training. And the third is that training without them just doesn't work very well. So I'll try to go into those three aspects in more detail with you. How did the precepts, as we know them now, and as they will be read to you this evening in the Kyoju Kaimon, how did they become the way of becoming a Buddhist in our tradition? I'm going to give you a little history lesson. And this is not my usual Dharma talk, because it's going to be highly intellectual. In fact, I felt like I was going back to graduate school last week when I was preparing this. I was driving myself rather crazy. I had books and papers and reprints all over my desk, and I was saying, I thought I'd left this behind. But I suppose those skills do serve a certain purpose once in a while. So bear with me. The first part of this talk will be a history lesson. And I thought it might, however, it shows, I learned some things from it, and perhaps it will give you some perspective on one of the reasons we make such a fuss about the precepts. The precepts are as old as Buddhism itself. While there are no written records from the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, it would appear that he set forth at least two sets of precepts, one for the lay followers and another more extensive one for the male and female monks, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. The lay precepts were expounded by the Buddha in several different forms, not in a uniform form, always the same. He suited the particular emphasis to the particular people he was teaching at the time and to their circumstances. But there was a common core to this teaching. And at some point, unknown, in early Buddhist history, five precepts that he set forth for the householder Anathapindika were adopted as the standard set of precepts for the laity. And these have come down to us relatively unchanged today. And they form the core of the commitment for householders of most Buddhist traditions, including our own. From a very early time, these were given to a person at the time of becoming a Buddhist. They were, in a sense, the defining event of becoming a Buddhist from very, very ancient times. And they would then be recited thereafter on numerous occasions. Just as those of you who are not here for the first time will realize that we recite our precepts on many different occasions. The lay precepts for recitation are known as the Panchasila. And this can be found in the Pali language for recitation in our own liturgy of the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives for the Laity book. These five precepts are to abstain from the taking of life, to abstain from taking what does not belong to one, to abstain from sexual misconduct, from lying or false speech, and from becoming intoxicated. Now, when you look at the precepts that will be read to you tonight in the Kyoju Kaimon, it's apparent that the first five of the 10 great precepts in the Kyoju Kaimon are closely related to these Panchasila precepts, but they aren't exactly the same. There are two differences. First difference is that the third precept on sexual misconduct has been broadened. It's been broadened to include all of covetousness, of which you can view sexual misconduct as a subcategory of that. The second change that you'll note is that the fifth one on becoming intoxicated has been both broadened and switched around in its emphasis, switched around outward towards other sentient beings instead of inward towards oneself, and it's become selling the wine of delusion. Delusion instead of simple intoxication, i.e. a much broader precept, and selling it, trafficking, as it were, in delusion to others, as opposed to simply indulging it oneself. Now, the first of these two changes, the one broadening sexual misconduct to all of covetousness, is characteristic of our own order, and it reflects Forever Master Jiyu's broad view of this precept as having implications far beyond simply sexual behavior. Other Soto groups that you find, other Soto Zen groups, will typically use the more traditional and specific definition of this precept. And as a matter of fact, Reverend Master Jiyu did so on certain circumstances herself. The change in the precept about intoxicants is much, much older. It is in fact found throughout the Mahayana branch of Buddhism, and it reflects the primary concern of the Mahayana about the effects of one's behavior upon others. It dates back to the time of the Brahmajala Sutra. Now, this is the sutra that you'll find translated by Reverend Hubert in Buddhist writings under the title the Scripture of Brahma's Net. It dates to somewhere before the 5th century of the Common Era. Common Era, by the way, is current scholars talk for A.D. B.C. is B.C.E., before Common Era. A.D. is C.E., Common Era. Okay. And in the Brahmajala, the Scripture of Brahma's Net, it transfers the precept on obtaining from intoxicants to a lesser section of the scripture. You'll still find it in there. It's just in one of the less grave precepts instead of one of the grave precepts. And it substitutes, in place of that precept, in the grave precept section, the one that you find in terms of trafficking in or selling intoxicants instead of simply taking them oneself. Now, the generalizing of that to delusion instead of simply intoxication again reflects Reverend Master Jiyu's own broad view of the precepts. Obviously, intoxication is one form of delusion, but there are lots of others. And you'll find, by the way, as you live with these precepts for a long time, that they do this all on their own. They broaden themselves. Your understanding of them, as it deepens and as your practice of them becomes more your blood and bones, they change in their meanings. It's actually quite lovely. They keep doing this, by the way. I have no idea how many changes happen, because it keeps happening, at least to me, and I've been at it for 29 years now. And in view of that kind of broadening and deepening process, her thought was, well, let's phrase a few of these in the broader way, right from the start. And that's what she did with those particular forms. Although, again, under certain circumstances, she too would use the more original, more specific form that's found in the Panchasila. Well, okay, that gets us five precepts, but the Kyoju Kaimon has 16. Where'd the other 11 come from? In order to answer that, we're going to have to digress a little bit into the history of the monastic precepts. Now, it is thought that during his lifetime, the Buddha set forth somewhere between 150 and 200 precepts for the bhikkhus, the male monks, and more for the bhikkhunis, the female monks. But we don't know exactly how many. These were recited by the assembled community of the Sangha every 2 weeks. And a list of them was made up for that recitation. And the list of precepts for recitation is called pratimoksha. And that's a term that Rev. Master Echo introduced to you last night. This bi-monthly act of recitation of vows has come down within our own tradition and is found in the renewal of vows ceremony, which is found in the monastic office, and which, if I remember our schedule for this retreat correctly, you will have a chance to see and participate in, if you wish, on the very last day. Now, the form of the ceremony and the list of rules of pratimoksha, however, have undergone considerable evolution over the course of Buddhist history. This started in the year following the Buddha's parinirvana. A process of codification of the monastic rules started, beginning with the first council. And other councils, grand councils of the Sangha, were held in subsequent years. And these, plus the work of lesser unknown meetings of the bhikkhus, resulted by the second century before the Common Era in a well-organized set of rules, case histories, and commentaries known as Vinaya. Some 227 rules are contained in this work for the bhikkhus and around 311 for the bhikkhunis. This forms the monastic rule of the Theravada tradition to this day. And I'll refer to these as the bhikkhu precepts. There are no current bhikkhuni precepts in that tradition, as the bhikkhuni order died out. And since one of the rules was that only a bhikkhuni could ordain another woman, it could not be revived. And the issue of how it might be possible to revive it at the present time, revive this monastic tradition for women, is one which the Theravada branch of Buddhism is deeply considering. Within the Mahayana branch, which is the branch to which we belong, there was considerable evolution of the precepts over the years. The first major change to occur was an expansion of the bhikkhu precepts to number somewhere around 250 instead of 227. And we know that this had taken place at least by the 7th century of the Common Era, probably before, but we don't know how much before. Presumably, a similar expansion of the bhikkhuni precepts also occurred, since as Mahayana Buddhism became established, the number of monastic precepts was standardized at 250 for the bhikkhus and 348 for the bhikkhunis. And the bhikkhuni order in Mahayana Buddhism did not die out and continues to this day, taking 348 precepts. This set, 250, 348, is still used in the Chinese and related traditions of Mahayana Buddhism. I'll refer to it as the Mahayana Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni precepts. Now, this expansion of number helped some things, but it wasn't entirely satisfactory. First of all, the precepts which were added were mostly minor ones. And this left some major issues within Mahayana Buddhism, such as, for instance, vegetarianism, which is not found as an absolute precept in the Theravada or the original early Buddhism, but is in the Mahayana, left that unaddressed, and similar things. Secondly, the primary emphasis in the bhikkhu precepts is on actions that have consequences for yourself, whereas the Mahayana is more concerned about the consequences of one's behavior for others. Thirdly, a number of the bhikkhu precepts, having been formulated 1,000 years earlier than this, were really no longer applicable to Mahayana practice. And because they were not easily applicable, in some cases very difficult to apply them, they became widely ignored. In other words, in the monastic sangha, one would take, say, 250 precepts, but one wouldn't actually keep them all. This was seen to be a rather unhealthy situation, because it tends to promote confusion and sometimes even ethical laxity, since if some precepts are taken but not kept, the question arises as to which others might be ignored as well. Now, these critiques of the Mahayana, Bhikkhu, and Bhikkhuni precepts have been made down the centuries and they actually continue today. Sometime around the 4th century, a new sutra appeared, and that was the Brahmajala. This has been translated as the scripture of Brahma's net, as you know. Now, in this new sutra, a unique Mahayana set of 58 precepts is set forth. 10 grave ones, 48 less grave ones. I'll refer to these as the Bodhisattva precepts. The first 10 were placed on a level of gravity equal to that of the first 4 of the Bhikkhu precepts. These were known as parajikas, or cases of defeat. They are the most serious of the precepts in the monastic Sangha. But now, in addition to the first 3 of these original 4 cases of defeat, which were violation of celibacy for monks, the taking of a human life, and theft, in addition to the 3 out of the first 4, the Brahmajala added a bunch of others at the same level of severity. It added trafficking in intoxicants, speaking disparagingly of other Buddhists, being proud of oneself and devaluing others, being stingy with either Dharma or wealth, feeding one's anger, and devaluing the 3 treasures. The 4th of the Bhikkhu Parajika offenses, making false claims of spiritual attainment, was generalized to all serious forms of false speech. Now, in those 10, you're beginning to recognize a similarity with the 10 precepts of the Kyoju Kaimon. The 48 less grave precepts were similar in number to the 45 precepts of serious and medium severity in the Bhikkhu precepts, but the emphasis was changed radically. Over 2/3 of the latter are concerned with monastic robes and vestments, the details of monastic chastity, and how money and property are to be dealt with by the Sangha, whereas the vast majority of the less grave Bodhisattva precepts are about failures in making offerings of Dhamma or other charity, failures in devoting oneself to religious practice, violations of the principle of nonviolence, and profiting unfairly at the expense of others. This shift in emphasis brings the precepts to bear upon the major issues of Mahayana practice, and it also addresses the concerns of the Mahayana for the welfare of others. Another characteristic of the Bodhisattva precepts is the general nature of the language they use. Instead of being framed to deal with the details of daily monastic life, they're worded so as to present general principles of ethical behavior. This feature of the Bodhisattva precepts in the Brahmajala means that they are applicable to both monastics and householders, and that is another major innovation of the Mahayana. When you read those over, you'll note that some are worded as if they apply primarily to one group and some to the other. And they are. But because they are all phrased as general principles, it's fairly easy to understand how all of them can be applied to both branches of the Sangha. The arising of the Bodhisattva precepts was not the only innovation made by Indian Mahayana Buddhism. Another great Mahayana sutra, the Avatamsaka, or Flower Ornament Sutra, appeared even earlier than the Brahmajala. In this sutra is found a new form of 3 general ethical principles known as the 3 fundamental precepts, or 3 pure precepts. The first 2 of these, to cease from evil or the causing of harm, and to do only that which is good, are the same in both the Avatamsaka and in early pre-Mahayana scriptures. The 3rd one, however, has been given a new and distinctly Mahayana meaning. Instead of being rendered as to cleanse or purify one's mind, it takes the form of to do good for others or to benefit sentient beings. With this change, Mahayana teachers soon realized that these three pure precepts formed a broad framework within which both the Mahayana Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni precepts and the Bodhisattva precepts could be understood and could be applied. The three pure precepts, in other words, shed light on all of the specific ones and provide an overview and a guiding principle that is more general than any of them. This made it possible for monks to take all three sets of precepts, the three pure precepts, the Bodhisattva precepts as a guide to general principle, and the Mahayana Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni precepts as rules for monastic practice. This three-part system came to China and other Far Eastern countries with Mahayana Buddhism, and it is practiced today in most of them. I'll refer to this as the mixed precepts system. Under this system, when one became a lay Buddhist, one would usually take the three pure precepts and the five precepts of the Panchasila, following these at a later time with the Bodhisattva precepts. Now, while adopting this mixed precept system dealt with the problem of how to provide for an emphasis on benevolence to others, and it addressed important Mahayana issues, it didn't handle the problem of monks taking a number of precepts that would not actually be kept. In fact, it may have made the matter worse. For now, in addition to some of the Mahayana Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni precepts not being kept because they were irrelevant to the cultures and practices of the time, some of those were now seen as being in actual conflict with the Bodhisattva precepts. And there arose a saying in Chinese Mahayana Buddhism that, quote, to keep the Bhikkhu precepts is to break the Bodhisattva precepts. But since the taking of the Bodhisattva precepts could be done by both householders and monks alike, whereas the taking of the Mahayana Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni precepts at ordination was considered definitive for becoming a monastic, no monk dared to drop the latter from the mixed precept system for fear of being regarded as illegitimate. No one, that is, until the year 818. In that year, in Japan, the Tendai monk Saicho petitioned the imperial government for permission to undertake a new system of monastic ordination based solely upon the three pure precepts and the Bodhisattva precepts. This was granted, although not without protest from the more conservative monks of the Buddhist monastic center of Nara. This new form of ordination did seem to meet a need, however, and it spread throughout most of Japanese Buddhism over the course of the next 300 years. But, as all things do, the system had its own set of problems. And while Saicho's reform had been promulgated as a means of stemming the tide of moral confusion and laxity within the Sangha of his day, by the time of several hundred years later, in the Kamakura period, the same criticism was being leveled against it. One of the arguments was that he had traded a system encumbered with overly specific and irrelevant rules for one with insufficient specificity. The general principles of the three pure precepts and the 58 Brahmajala precepts, in other words, were unfortunately sufficiently broad as to be open to misinterpretations that could be used to justify unethical behavior. But they had to be broad because they were general principles. Within the Zen schools, this dissatisfaction with Saicho's system was one of the motivating factors impelling such monks as Esai, his disciple Myozen, and his grand disciple Dogen to visit China in search of a better way. The former two of these monks, discerned that the best approach would be to return to the mixed precepts system. But Dogen disagreed. His insistence on this did not make life easy for him in China. For while the Bodhisattva precept ordination of Saicho was regarded as legitimate in Japan, the same was not generally true elsewhere. In fact, in most of the Chinese temples that Dogen visited and studied at, he was regarded as a novice monk with no seniority at all, because he had not taken the Mahayana bhikkhu precepts. Although the view that these were the defining precepts for monastic ordination was generally held, it was not, however, universal. One of the monks who did not hold it was the eminent meditation master Ju Qing, Tendo Nyojo. Thus, when Dogen applied to enter Ju Qing's meditation hall at the great monastery on Tiantong Mountain, Tendozan, which, by the way, is where that incense comes from, in the year 1225, not only did Ju Qing accept him, which was unusual at the time because most applicants to Tendozan were turned away for having insufficient sincerity. Ju Qing was a very strict master. Not only did he accept Dogen, but he accepted him as a fully ordained monk. Now, this treatment was not reserved solely for Dogen, for there's evidence that Ju Qing maintained that it was the Bodhisattva precepts alone that determined a monk's legitimacy and seniority, and that such was the authentically transmitted teaching of the Tsautung or Soto sect. It was while studying with Ju Qing that Dogen found his answer to the problem of the Bodhisattva precepts being insufficiently specific, for it was here that he encountered the rules of Pai Cheng. This was a set of monastic rules attributed to the famous 8th century master whom we know today under three different names, Pai Cheng, Hui Hai, and Hyakujo. The guiding principle of this work and of its many successor volumes of Zen monastic rules was that the rules governing Zen monks should be based solely upon the actual conditions which were suitable to Zen practice at the time, and that these rules should neither be restricted by nor stand against the spirit of either the Mahayana Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni precepts or the Bodhisattva precepts. The original rules of Pai Cheng have been lost, but some of their successors still exist, including a 12th century document, the Chan Wan Ching Kui, or Rules of Purity for Chan Monasteries, which would have been what was used in Ju Qing's temple. It contains rules for how to celebrate various ceremonies, the duties of temple officers and how they are to be fulfilled, the preparation of food, the care of the sick, monastic obedience and etiquette, and a variety of minor matters. In other words, it covers many of the same areas mentioned in the Mahayana Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni precepts, but it deals with them in the context of the Zen monastic training of the day. When Dogen returned to Japan, he was able to introduce another system of precepts. At its core were the 10 grave precepts of the Brahmajala. To this, he added the 3 pure precepts in the form set forth in the Avatamsaka as general guidelines for understanding and applying the 10 precepts. And above these, he added the 3 refuges. Prior to Dogen, there seems to be no record of anyone considering the refuges to be a type of precept. His insight was to see that the 3 refuges in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, when undertaken together as one thing, give an even more broad overview of the precepts than do the 3 pure precepts. It is from the taking of refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha that all precepts flow forth, and it is within those refuges that all may be understood and applied. This, then, yields the 16 precepts of the Kyoju Kaimon, a document which Dogen himself authored, and which is what will be read to you tonight. For his lay followers, Dogen made use of both the Kyoju Kaimon and the Brahmajala. The latter was taken by householders who wished to do so when they attended his bi-monthly recitations of the Brahmajala with the monks. This is the same practice that we follow today. Presumably, as we do today, it would have been made clear to them that these precepts have different interpretations for the householder and for the monastic. For instance, the 3rd grave precept against entertaining lustfulness is not considered to require celibacy for the laity, but it is for the monks. And there are many other different emphases that need to be pointed out. Now, it's not exactly certain how Dogen himself used the Kyoju Kaimon with his lay followers. But we do know that shortly after the time of his great-grand disciple, Keizan Jokin, a ceremonial form arose for giving them at the time of becoming a Buddhist. This was called Jukai, the opening of the gate of the precepts. In the Jukai of Keizan's time, or his disciples' time, and we're speaking here in the 14th century, what would happen would be that large numbers of lay people would come to the monastery. They would live together with the monks for a number of days. They would receive the Kyoju Kaimon precepts, participate in a number of solemn ceremonies, and receive a bloodline certificate known as Kechi Myaku. In other words, by the 14th century, they were doing essentially the same Jukai which we will do this week. Whether we can credit Keizan with formulating the ceremonies of Jukai is unknown, although it does seem quite possible, since he is the author of many of our ceremonies, and since one of his own disciples is known to have held them. This, then, is where our 16 precepts and our ceremonies of Jukai come from, and our retreat of Jukai week comes from. During each period in this history, from the earliest Buddhism to today, the receiving and the keeping of precepts has been synonymous with becoming a Buddhist. But why? Why is it synonymous with becoming a Buddhist? Why does it take this crucial role in the history of Buddhism? Well, as I alluded to at the beginning, one of the reasons is that the keeping of them is the single most effective thing you can do to undertake Buddhist training. Let me go back to the time of Shakyamuni. He would expound the precepts to people, as I said, in varying sets, in answers to their questions. What were the questions that he would answer with the precepts? Well, there were questions such as, how may I live a happy life? How may I be contented? How may I be at peace with myself and my fellow human beings? What tends most towards the path of enlightenment? How may my karma be set to rest, and how may merit be created for the benefit of self and others? It was to questions such as that, fundamental questions of training, that he would expound some form of the precepts. It's obvious that he felt that they were an extraordinarily effective means of training. Now, not only can the precepts be done right now, but they will also have their effect relatively quickly. In this, they are distinguished from meditation and mindfulness, the other core aspects of our Zen practice. Meditation and mindfulness are essential, and we introduce them, as you know, to people as soon as possible. And they take time to have their effects. They are very powerful. They are also subtle. And their effects, although present, are often unnoticed for many, many years. Deeply undertaking to follow the precepts can have a profound effect immediately. And it's an effect not only on what one does, but how one thinks and how one is. Undertake these precepts wholeheartedly, or deepen the level at which you have already undertaken them, and you will notice a difference. Therefore, the precepts are the best possible place to start from and to come back to. You come back to them, as I said before, because your understanding deepens and widens. And it does so under the guidance and effect of the subtle business of meditation and mindfulness. So that these precepts are ever new. And that's one of the reasons why you will see people coming back to Jukai to renew their vows to keep them time and time again. Now, Reverend Master Ekyo gave you a number of other reasons last night why the precepts occupy a central place in our form of Buddhist training. I will not repeat those, other than to expand upon his point that the precepts are more than simply proscriptions, rules against stuff. They are that, but they are more than that. They are also descriptions. And as he mentioned, they are descriptions of how one behaves like a Buddha. Now, if it is your wish to become as Buddha, then behaving as Buddha is an excellent place to start. For being Buddha is a matter of both what you do and what you are. And what you do has a profound impact upon how and what you are. In fact, there is literally no point in doing the inner practice of mindfulness and meditation while ignoring the outer practice of perceptual living, because these are not two separate things. To consider them two separate things is to divide practice and enlightenment and split it up, and it is a whole thing. To devote oneself to mindfulness and meditation without the precepts is actually to work against oneself, and it makes no sense. Which leads me to my final set of observations. Another reason for making a fuss about the precepts is that training just doesn't go very well without them. Now, we've already seen the major reason for that. That is that our actions are inseparable from the unified whole that is training, that is being Buddhist. But it is understandable why some people resist the taking of the precepts, or even having taken them from time to time, resist the keeping of them. I'm familiar with that once in a while myself. Of course, they rub against things in one's being, in one's nature. And that is beneficial because it shows you things. But the fact is that it does sometimes rub. And that's not always pleasant. But we never said this was going to be always pleasant or easy. It is the uncompromising search for the truth, the uncompromising search to be a decent human being and benefit both self and other through that. One of the reasons that sometimes arises for this resistance is that the precepts start looking like just one more set of rules. And many of us have had more than enough rules in our lifetimes. Well, if and when that arises, I would say, yes, they are. And no, actually they aren't. As was mentioned to you last night, they are rules, and they are also more than rules. The difficult side, usually, is when we think of them as rules. So, all right, let's look at them as rules. They're rules, but they're not commandments in the way in which many of us encountered commandments in Sunday school. They're not given from a creator God. Where do they come from? Well, the Buddha enunciated them, all right, and so have masters down the centuries. But that's not where they come from. They come, as Reverend Master Ekyo pointed out last night, from the Buddha mind, from something which we all share and which is greater than any one of us. They are descriptions of the Buddha mind. They are descriptions, in a sense, of how the universe actually works on a grand scale over long periods of time. Secondly, as rules, they're undertaken voluntarily. And that makes a big difference. Thirdly, as rules, the consequences for both keeping and for breaking them are purely natural. This is not a matter of salvation or sin. It's a matter of wisdom or suffering. And the suffering comes purely from the natural law of karma. Breaking the precepts has consequences. They're natural consequences. They're not imposed by anyone. They simply happen. And a description of that is included in the law of karma. Even their form is not quite what it seems as rules. The Kyoju Kaimon form, which you've read, which will be read to you tonight, was written by Dogen in a very brief, telegraphic almost form, an extremely simple form. For instance, the first one, do not kill. Okay, that is useful. It keeps things simple. It keeps things easy to remember. And it puts them right there in your face. And sometimes that's useful. They are not, in other words, as Reverend Master Echo has also pointed out upon occasion, the 10 suggestions. And sometimes that's very useful to keep in mind. Sometimes we need that. And at the same time, it is useful to recognize that this telegraphic brief form is an abbreviation of the older form. Do not kill is an abbreviation of Panatipata Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. I vow to undertake the way of training that I may abstain from, in this case, killing living things. This was mentioned to you last night. If you look at them in this form, it can undercut the difficulties with seeing them as pseudo-commandments. And understood in this form, it's interesting that they're both easier to break and also easier to keep. They're easier to break in the extended form because there are more aspects at which they can be broken. For instance, okay, I vow to undertake the way of training that I may abstain from X. I vow. Well, it can be broken at that point. No, I don't. I don't care today. Well, you may not take the life of any sentient being, but the I don't give a darn breaks the vowing part. I vow to undertake. Okay. Yeah, but I'm going to make an exception at this point. Okay. That breaks the undertaking part. The vow's still there, and you didn't kill any sentient beings, and you're still training, but you've broken the undertaking part. I vow to undertake the way of training. Well, you can break that by, you know, I'm going to ignore this part of training today and take my chances and see, okay? Now, with any luck, you still won't kill any sentient beings. And the vow's still there. You're just sort of ignoring it for today. And that breaks the way of training part. But other aspects of training are still there. And finally, the abstain from doing part. That can be broken by doing the act itself. But note that doing the act itself may well not break the vow to undertake the way of training parts. In fact, it often doesn't, and that's why one feels so rotten when one actually fails to abstain from X. Because the vow is still there. The undertaking is still there, and the way of training is still there, and it makes the whole thing extraordinarily uncomfortable. So it's easier to keep the precepts because it's very rare that all aspects would be broken at the same time. And even when the part that one breaks is the act itself, the fact that the other parts may well still be intact opens the door to the honest self-examination and regret without guilt, which we call Sangha, and which will be discussed in a couple of days. Finally, a training without the precepts is also just plain a risky business. Yes, the precepts do come from that place, the Buddha mind, which is touched by meditation. And, yes, in the process of finding that place, precepts are, in a sense, unnecessary. That is, they flow forth naturally. As rules, when one is in that place, they just drop away. One naturally behaves according to the precepts. It is, as we will put it at the day of Kechimyaku, that they have become one's blood and bones. Now, the process of finding that place, however, is a circuitous one. And one of the things that you may well find is that meditation, which is an integral part of that process, has some rather radical effects on a person. And one of its radical effects is that it undermines all of our old ways of being that we got taught. It undermines them so that something more fundamental has a chance to come up and to be part of one and to be seen. But one of the old things that gets undermined is our conventional morality. So there is, in some people's training, this rather interesting space of rough water where the old rules for living are sort of all falling apart. And one has not yet come to more than just a glimpse, maybe, of that place from which the precepts flow forth. The taking and keeping of precepts provides a safe bridge across this rough water. Because when nothing is making sense, you can look back to those precepts and say, ah, okay, I don't know, in one sense, what's right here. But I know these things have served me well, so I'm going to trust them. I'm not going to break them. And in doing that, without brainwashing yourself, just by trusting what has been wise for generations upon generations upon generations, and putting that into practice, allows for the safety to have all sorts of other things crumble away. And still, you do not do that which will be a cause later on for profound regret. Another benefit of the precepts at these awkward times of training is that they identify sidetracks for you. There are lots of sidetracks in training. That's one of the reasons why I think that Dogen set forth the three refuges as the overriding precept of all. Taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha simultaneously is a great way of identifying a sidetrack when you find yourself on it. So are the specific precepts of the ten. If you find yourself doing things which violate those, it's a pretty clear sign that you're on some kind of a sidetrack. So the precepts are of great use in recognizing sidetracks quickly so that you can get off of them. And training without them, for that reason, is a risky business. To think that one can train without them is actually a form of spiritual pride. Yes, in theory, it would be possible if you could jump directly to that place of Buddha mind and stay there. I can't do that. I get there sometimes, but sometimes I'm not there. I need all the help I can get. Why would I want to reinvent the wheel with regard to training when through the compassion of the Buddhas and ancestors, they have passed down something that works and makes this safe. Thus it is that Dogen Zenji, in the very lecture at which he answers many questions on practice with the invariable response that it is meditation that is foremost, says about the precepts the following. He's asked the question, must one who takes the practice of meditation seriously keep the precepts strictly and purify both body and mind? And this is the guy who's just been saying meditation is the thing. And here's how he answers this question. The Buddhas and ancestors have handed down the practice of strict observance of the precepts and of pure living as the rules governing Zen. Any who have not yet received the precepts should do so at once. They who have broken them should repent of their wrongdoing. By this, all may become one with the wisdom of the Buddhas. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, homage to the Sangha.